Welcome. My name is John Callodine, and in this podcast, I'm endeavouring to address some of the key problem areas which charities face within their accounting records. I trust this will prove useful to both trustees and finance managers of charities, as well as those practitioners who deal with day-to-day accounting issues of charities, either in preparing accounts, doing independent examination, or annual audits. The first area I would like to address is that of fund accounting, the differences between unrestricted, restricted, designated, and endowment funds. Fund accounting can send tremors down the spine of the average accountant, for unlike in the business world, where the majority of transactions can go through the one profit and loss account, it is a requirement that the trustees apply the funds of a charity within the objects and for the purposes given. Therefore, charities have an additional requirement to account for more than one type of fund. It is not unlike the larger commercial world, where distinct divisions are kept, separate profit and loss accounts prepared for the sale of different products, or the trading activities of a separate division. Unrestricted funds are those funds available for use by the trustees within the general objects and powers of the charity. This can represent the core and underlying work of the charity, and that is why it is called the general fund. Trustees may put aside unrestricted general funds for specified purposes. These funds are then called designated funds, and often are specific and time limited. Restricted funds are those funds given for a purpose that is narrower than the general objects of the charity, although they still have to fall within the objects and are as determined by the donor. Endowment funds are those funds which are held on trust for the future benefit of the charity. If the capital cannot be spent, although it can fall and rise in value, it is a permanent endowment. If the capital can be spent, usually in prescribed circumstances, it is an expendable endowment. Unrestricted funds really just consist of the general fund, being the core work, but can be further broken down into designated funds, as I mentioned earlier. However, restricted funds can be made up of many separate individual projects and or funds. Eventually, a summary of all the restricted funds, that is the general and designated funds, has to be shown in the SOFA of the annual accounts, that is the statement of financial activities, and likewise the summary of all the restricted funds. It is not unusual for large charities to have many restricted funds, and separate movements of income and resources and monies expended need to be shown for each of these funds within a separate note to the balance sheet. Materiality and common sense has to be applied in the use of restricted funds, and reference always needs to be made to the wishes of the donor and or the source of the monies coming into the charity. Donations and gifts to the core work of the charity will go to the general fund. If specific requests are made by the donor, then consideration will need to be given as to whether a restricted fund needs to be set up, but there obviously needs to be reasons for this. Charities are often in receipt of legacies, and these can be substantial, and it may be set out in the will of the deceased that the money is to be given for a specific project which the charity is to undertake, or to use the money in a much more defined area. In very simple terms, if the charity is for animal welfare, and the legacy is given for the work in the establishment of a new centre for the welfare of dogs, then this would immediately become a restricted fund. Quite often, money is given to charities from central government or other sources, and invariably there are strings attached and conditions which would have to be adhered to. Often, full accountability will be needed in the disclosure of how the money is spent and dealt with, and this can only often be done through a separate restricted fund of the charity. I recently came across a case where a local council gave money to a local charity and asked for it to be treated as a restricted fund. But what concerned me was the terms of the grant were such that the work really was for the core underlying work of the charity. This will prove a challenging exercise for the charity to produce records of how the money is spent as distinguished from its ongoing and day-to-day work. The movement of cash between funds is an area which has to be carefully considered. There are no reasons whatsoever why monies cannot be moved by a charity from unrestricted funds to restricted funds. This would not be unusual, as money will be given for a specific project via a restricted fund, and perhaps would need topping up from the general funds of the charity to ensure that the project was fully carried out. Likewise, a charity can move monies from unrestricted funds to designated funds without any concerns whatsoever. A straightforward example would be the setting up of a roof repair fund, or monies put aside for future capital projects. That money can always be moved back at a later date from the designated fund to the unrestricted fund if it is not required. What is difficult and what has to be considered very carefully is when monies are moved from a restricted fund to a unrestricted fund. Ordinarily, you cannot do this. Monies in the restricted fund are given for a particular purpose and or project, and that money has to be used in accordance with the donor's wishes. A problem which often arises is that a charity has not got sufficient income to meet its day-to-day core costs, the underlying overhead costs of the organisation. Monies are given to the restricted fund for a project, but no consideration is given to meeting the day-to-day running costs. Very often in grant applications, a charity will try to build into its costings a percentage of money that can be transferred and utilised from the restricted fund for core costs, that is, management costs, etc. The full disclosure of this would be necessary to the donor and details disclosed within the financial statements of the charity. The second subject I would like to address is recognition of income. Auditors will be only too well aware of this phrase. How is income recognised to the statement of financial activities? The average layman may say, what is the difficulty? Monies come in and monies go out. Donations and gifts will be recorded as income with the corresponding expenditure. Unfortunately, it is not quite as simple as that. And there are three very useful words to address when considering monies that come into a charity as to when and how they go to the sofa, the balance sheet, or wherever. Those words being entitlement, certainty, and measurement. In relation to donations and gifts, there is no difficulty whatsoever. The money has arrived, the charity is entitled, it is certain, it can be measured, and therefore credit income. Likewise with general grants given for the core purposes of the charity without any restrictions. However, when dealing with specific grants, whether they are for the general work of the charity or a specific project, there are usually underlying terms and conditions, and these need to be studied as to when the money can be recognised to the sofa. If we look at legacies, they give us a fairly good understanding of how to use the words of entitlement, certainty, and measurement. The charity receives a letter from a firm of lawyers saying they are entitled to a legacy under the will of a deceased person. There is your entitlement. Is there certainty? Well, there may be a question mark here, for until such time as the estate is settled, one cannot be sure. If, however, it is a specific legacy, then obviously certainty is almost likely to be sure and the money can be measured in financial terms. If you are in receipt of monies as a residuary legacy, then measurement is unknown until the estate is finalised and received, and indeed there must be some uncertainty as to the level of money. Once the charity receives a letter from a firm of lawyers, there is no reason why this money cannot be recognised to the sofa, particularly if it is a specific legacy and if it is material, irrespective of whether the money has arrived, that is, debit debtors, credit income. In relation to residuary legacies, one would have to wait until the money actually arrives, as there is no measurement of the figure. Charities often carry out contractual arrangements, either with local authorities and or government departments, to deliver services. The terms of that contract will determine when the money being received is credited to the sofa. For example, the contract is secure to receive, say, £5,000 worth of income to carry out an event for that organisation to be held in 6 months' time. The money may well be paid up front. However, the charity cannot recognise this to its SOFA until such time as the event has taken place and expenditure incurred. The reason being that if the event does not take place, the money would have to be refunded. In those cases, the charity would be advised to defer the income to its balance sheet until such time they have delivered the services required. Ongoing contractual arrangements to carry out projects where money is received on a regular basis would be treated somewhat differently, the money being recognised to the SOFA upon receipt, irrespective of whether they have incurred corresponding expenditure. This is a grey area, but as long as the charity is involved in producing ongoing services in relation to the terms of the contract, the money should be credited to that particular fund. It may be left to the charity as and when it spends the money, although at some point they would have to give account of how this was done. Match funding is an interesting subject. Very often grants or monies are given to a charity conditional upon match funding, that is, additional funding to the project, being obtained. Therefore, until such time as the charity has obtained the additional match funding, they cannot recognise the income received. If the money is lying in their bank account, this again may have to be deferred to the balance sheet until such time as they can fulfil the terms of the contract. Another interesting term I've come across recently is dual funding. And this was in the contract I referred to earlier in this podcast about a local council giving funding to a project but saying that dual funding cannot be obtained. The problem here was that the work being undertaken by this charity was its core purpose, which has left a very difficult and tricky situation to be resolved. Another accounting issue I find with charities not found in the business world are gifts in kind, donated services. Many charities, of course, utilise the services of a number of volunteers completely free of charge, and it would be unproductive and of no real significant use to value this. However, if the charity were to have received the seconded services of an additional member of staff, then the value of those services should be considered and recognised to the accounts, that is, credit donated services, debit cost of those services, that is, salary. I came across this very markedly with another charity, where HM Revenue and Customs very graciously donated the services of one of its staff to a local charity for 1 year. This was a simple exercise from an accounting point of view. We ascertained the salary being paid by HMRC to this person, and then debited salary costs, and then credited donated services with the corresponding figure. Many charities receive gifts in kind, possibly goods for resale or fixed assets, works of art, etc. These would have to be valued, and if the monies involved were significant, a proper valuation carried out, and a disclosure note made in the accounting policies of the charity. Gifts of small items of equipment, computers, office equipment, etc., may be shown within the financial statements. But materiality would have to be applied, and does a computer have a second-hand value? Likewise, significant works of art, treasure trove items, may need to be shown in the balance sheet as a fixed asset investment and a proper market valuation applied. This brings me to the final part of this podcast. How do you deal with the corresponding expenditure, the allocation of costs? It is considered best practice within the SOFA to distinguish the costs of the charity between the following major headings. 1. Costs of generating funds, that is, voluntary income and fundraising activities. 2. The charitable activities, the various projects of the charity. And 3. Governance costs. Governance costs are fairly straightforward to deal with, in that they really relate to costs such as auditing, independent examination, bank charges, and possibly part of a chief executive's salary in dealing with governance issues. Charitable activities are the core work of the charity in delivering the projects and services, whilst the costs of generating funds will be salaries and other costs of departments dealing with fundraising activities. The issue arises as to how does the salary of the staff, who deal with all these various aspects of a charity's work, get apportioned? It is very common to find in charity accounts a heading called support costs, which relate to all the various overhead expenses required to deliver the services, but are not direct costs. A charity worker, specifically employed to carry out a project and deliver services, will be shown under charitable activities and under that particular project in a separate fund. However, the costs of the finance manager would need to be apportioned between the various departments, likewise the chief executive and other support staff. There are various ways of doing this. It can be done in terms of time spent on projects, the number of people involved, perhaps the floor area of the charity's offices. Whatever method is chosen needs to be fair and consistently applied, and disclosures made in the charity accounts. I hope you have found this podcast helpful.